sterilized everybody who was positive for HIV. And so we imagine that the U.S. has no viruses in it, that they're somewhere else. But with monkeypox and COVID, we are the leading country in the world with these infections. And so it's not a matter of keeping them out. It's a matter of dealing with them inside the borders of our own country and working with other countries to lower transmission.
We're showing images by Molly Crabapple, by the way, who illustrates your book. Amazing. We're going to do more in part two, but we only have 20 seconds. Not a single vaccine has made it to Africa.
That's certainly my understanding. I know that none had made it to Nigeria, where Dr. Ogwuena had done this really amazing work. And if we had dealt with these countries and helped them earlier, we would not be dealing with this global pandemic now.
And we're going to talk much more extensively about this in part two and post it at democracynow.org. Stephen Thrasher, LGBTQ scholar and journalist. His new book, The Viral Underclass, The Human Toll When Inequality and Disease Collide. That does it for our show. A belated happy birthday to Rob Young. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, wear a mask.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Remembering Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Building Toward Nuclear Justice, on Monday, August 8th from 6 to 7:15 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza on the Portland waterfront. This memorial features speakers and performers representing communities on the front lines of nuclear injustice. That's Remembering Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Building Toward Nuclear Justice, on Monday, August 8th from 6 to 7:15 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza on Northwest NATO Parkway and Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm. On the right side of the homepage, under Community Events.
Every single person since SB8 has been a law has needed to travel out of state. Every single person that's reached our line.
We've been clinging on to Roe versus Wade and the protection that it offered. And it feels as though that protection is being taken away from us. So it feels as though this is a moment of survival. And I think any moments of survival can be very scary.
What did abortion access look like in America when Roe was the law of the land? Tune into KBOO's Roe on the Rocks, a limited series podcast where I investigate this question as I take you through the months leading up to the U.S. Supreme Court decision that effectively overturned Roe. That's Roe on the Rocks, airing Thursdays at 9 a.m. You don't want to miss it.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a Patriot Prayer member will serve 3 days in jail for a 2019 brawl. Oregon law enforcement has new conduct rules on the horizon. And in international news, the UN Secretary General warns of increased nuclear threat. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 2nd, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. Patriot Prayer brawler Mackenzie Lewis will serve 3 days in jail and 3 years probation for the Cider Riot fight on May Day 2019. Other Patriot Prayer members were acquitted of this charge, including Joey Gibson. Lewis was found guilty on one felony riot charge for his involvement in the brawl. Prosecution pushed for 30 days in jail, but Lewis asked for mercy, citing the need to support his family and an upcoming plumber's apprenticeship that he didn't want to miss. The judge landed on 3 days in jail, served non-consecutively on a schedule of Lewis's choosing. His three-year probation states that he must immediately leave any protest declared unlawful by police. Last week's record-breaking heat wave in Oregon now has a suspected death toll of 15 across the state. Multnomah County has the highest number, 7 suspected heat-related deaths. Washington, Clackamas, Umatilla, and Marion counties also reported possible hyperthermia deaths. Oregon State Police are investigating these deaths and will release a full report confirming the hyperthermia deaths once it's complete. Law enforcement in Oregon has new proposed standards published yesterday. Public comment is open on the new rules until October, when they'll be adopted. KBOO's Josh Salem has more.
A proposed set of conduct and discipline standards applicable to all law enforcement agencies in Oregon were published yesterday. The commission charged with establishing the new rules still left room for officers found to have committed serious and even illegal offenses to keep their jobs, if there were mitigating circumstances. For example, commissioners voted against making sexual assault an automatically fireable offense. Portland Police Association attorney Anil Kuria said, quote, "There are things like state of mind or absence of intent that could come into play, or degree of harm. There are nuances in this," end quote. The commission was formed when House Bill 2930 passed in 2021. It was one of several pieces of legislation addressing police accountability and reform. Bill's sponsor, Representative Janelle Bynum, Democrat Clackamas, said, quote, "Officers like to have clarity, some level of certainty about what the standards are," end quote. Having one statewide set of guidelines should prevent officers who have discipline problems in one local department from transferring to a different agency that has lower standards. The standards address issues ranging from unjustified use of force to targeting someone based solely on their race, gender, or other protected status. The commission will hold a series of public hearings throughout August and mid-September. They should take public comments under consideration and make any changes before the rules take effect on October 1st. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Primaries are taking place today in multiple states, including Washington. With that story and more, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Multiple times, the Ohio Redistricting Commission has not listened. The state legislature has not listened when it comes to map making.
Primary elections happen in 6 states today, including Ohio, where voting rights advocates like Catherine Turser of Common Cause say redistricting reforms have failed. Ohio's state legislative primary comes 3 months after its statewide and congressional contests. Legal wrangling over redistricting delayed the legislative races. Former Missouri Governor Eric Greitens, who resigned over a scandal, is running for the Missouri seat, being vacated by retiring Senator Roy Blunt. He is backed by former President Donald Trump, who continues to target political adversaries, including the 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach him in 2021. One is on the ballot today in Washington and 2 in Michigan. One of Michigan's Republican gubernatorial candidates was charged in the January 6th Capitol attack, and Kansas voters will decide on a referendum which would pave the way for further abortion restrictions. President Joe Biden confirmed a U.S. drone strike in Afghanistan killed the top leader of al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who took over leadership of the group after Osama bin Laden's death.
To those around the world who continue to seek to harm the United States, hear me now. We will always remain vigilant, and we will act.
Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi is expected to make an unannounced stop in Taiwan, the self-ruled island China claims as its own. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said it shouldn't be viewed as a U.S. provocation.
There's no reason to use a potential visit to justify or to spark some sort of crisis or conflict.
Citing the Russian invasion of Ukraine, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says this is a time of nuclear threat not seen since the height of the Cold War.
Today, humanity is just one misunderstanding, one miscalculation away from nuclear annihilation.
He spoke at a New York conference of countries belonging to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is dismissing projections a climate and energy package would raise taxes for many Americans.
Instead, It will close loopholes long exploited by the largest corporations that essentially give them lower tax rates than many nurses, firefighters, teachers.
The Joint Committee on Taxation found the legislation would pass along costs to consumers, raising the effective tax burden on Americans with incomes of $200,000 or less. Schumer plans to hold a floor vote this week. Calling climate change an urgent crisis, Vice President Kamala Harris detailed more than $1 billion in federal spending to help communities prepare for and respond to climate-related disasters.
We can tackle the climate crisis and make sure all people can breathe clean air, drink clean water, and have access to clean energy.
Events are being held across the country today for a National Day of Action demanding President Biden declare a climate emergency. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find RA Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Inflation Reduction Act of 2022 has changes to out-of-pocket health care costs for Americans that rely on Medicare and other reforms aimed at lowering drug prices. A recent poll found 80% of voters feel their health care costs are rising each year. Nadia Ramlagan has more.
Democrats say they've reached an agreement on the Inflation Reduction Act, which includes measures aimed at lowering prescription drug prices. And Senate lawmakers could begin considering its passage this week. Donna Christensen is a board member of Consumers for Quality Care and a former Democratic congressional representative from the U.S. Virgin Islands. She says that if passed into law, the changes primarily would affect Americans relying on Medicare.
In Medicare Part D, there'll be a cap on out-of-pocket costs to the beneficiaries. I think that's a very good thing. We wish that it would be extended to the privately insured as well, though, because they are facing increasing out-of-pocket costs.
Major drug companies and other opponents argue the legislation will stifle innovation and reduce the number of new medications available to consumers. A recent survey from Consumers for Quality Care found 80% of voters feel their health care costs, including deductibles, out-of-pocket expenses, and unpaid medical bills, continue to increase each year. Christensen says research has shown the Affordable Care Act caps on out-of-pocket costs, which can stretch into the thousands of dollars depending on the medication, have proved too high for most individuals.
And it's causing people to delay or skip health care because they're afraid of incurring medical debt.
According to a Kaiser Family Foundation poll released earlier this year, 6 in 10 working-age adults with health insurance coverage have gone into debt getting medical care in the past 5 years. Advocates are calling on lawmakers to set affordable out-of-pocket caps and $35 a month copay caps on insulin for those covered by Medicare and private insurers. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Virginia News Connection.
According to new polling from AARP, women over the age of 50, a powerful voting bloc, are still undecided on which candidates to support in this midterm election. The same poll found younger women are more likely to vote in the upcoming midterm elections because of the Supreme Court decision to overturn federal abortion protections. Eric Gladys has more on the story.
Women voters age 50 and older haven't decided which candidates to support, and the direction they choose could determine the balance of power in Congress and state houses around the country, according to recent polls. Margie Omero is a member of a bipartisan team commissioned by AARP. She says women across the political spectrum are concerned about deepening political polarization getting in the way of solving problems.
And it's something, honestly, we hear from Democrats and Republicans and independents. It's almost the thing that unites us as a country, this worry that we're divided.
Surveyors found that the top issues for women voters age 50 and older are kitchen table economics and the day-to-day experience of rising prices. But by more than a 2-to-1 margin, women surveyed said they would vote for a candidate who was willing to work together to get things done, even if the result is an occasional compromise. Significant majorities give elected officials D and F grades on issues including prices rising faster than income, the cost of health care and prescription drugs, and the wage gap between rich and poor. Omero says women also report experiencing lingering impacts of the global pandemic.
Large numbers of women, about a third, said that they've been experiencing depression, grief, worries about family members getting ill, caregiving pressures, mental health challenges during the pandemic.
The AARP survey was completed before Roe v. Wade was overturned. Separate polling analysis by Tufts University suggests the Supreme Court decision will bring more younger women to the polls in November. Omero says women have always played an important role in election outcomes and expects this election to be no different.
Older voters in general are reliable voters, and so this is a group that's important to pay attention to because they vote and they haven't decided yet.
This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
The Center for American Progress has a new report on the overrepresentation of Latinos in low-wage jobs. Suzanne Potter has the story.
A new report finds that too many Latinos are stuck in low-wage occupations, and some with darker skin face discrimination and an even steeper climb to the middle class. Statistics show about one-third of Nevada's population is Latino. Jessica Vela with the Center for American Progress says many Latino workers, particularly those of Mexican, Guatemalan, Honduran, and Salvadoran descent, toil in low-paying industries like hospitality or caregiving, rife with labor violations.
Hispanic and Latino workers make up a large part of the tipped worker population. Latinos are 17% of the overall workforce, but represent 24% of tipped employees.
The report notes that tipped workers often make sub-minimum wages, are at the mercy of the economy, and were laid off by the millions during the pandemic. It also found that Hispanic men had the highest unemployment rate during COVID, followed by Hispanic women. Vela notes that home care is one of the most common occupations for Mexican, Guatemalan, Honduran, Salvadoran, and Dominican women, and says all states should step in to require better working conditions.
California signed a statewide agreement with Child Care Providers United to increase wage rates. They subsidize child care slots, which can be incredibly helpful with many families needing to work.
Advocates are calling for a higher federal minimum wage and more grants to help people afford to go to college or a trade school. A recent report from Georgetown University found that Latinos make up about 37% of Nevada's college-age population, but only about 29% of students at four-year colleges and 36% at community colleges. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Nevada News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth. David Rosenberg speaks with an expert about the popularity and deception of artificial sweeteners. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX, then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will show clear skies with a low of 59. Tomorrow's weather will be mostly sunny with a high of 58. Today in history, in 1790, the first United States census was conducted. The quote of the day is from Warren G. Harding, the 29th president of the United States, who died on this day in 1923. Harding said, quote, "America's present need is not heroics, but healing, not nostrums, but normalcy, not revolution, but restoration." The Amamutsin tribe in the San Francisco Bay is fighting a plan for gravel mining on sacred land. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A tribe in the San Francisco Bay Area is fighting a proposal to develop a gravel pit mine on sacred land. Christina Onnested reports from California.
The Amamutsun tribe says sacred land 2 hours south of San Francisco near Gilroy must be preserved. Valentin Lopez is chairman of the Amamutsun tribal band.
Nuristock has been the most sacred site of the Amamutsun tribal band for thousands of years.
He says the land was stolen 150 years ago and never returned to the federally unrecognized tribe. And despite repeated attempts to this day, they've been denied access to what's now called Sargent Ranch. The Dead Acquisition Corporation of America bought the land and is seeking a permit for a sand and gravel mine on part of the land. The environmental impact report was just released. Lopez says it would be devastating to his tribe and the environment.
It identified significant and unmitigatable cultural resources and spiritual resources at Uruk-hai. It also identified they will have significant and unmitigatable conditions there to the wildlife, to the wildlife corridors, and to the waterways, etc. So the impact of this, of the mining permit, should it be approved, would be horrendous.
The company disputes the land is sacred to the tribe. The Yamamutsin tribe is calling on California's governor to step in and support a land-back reconciliation process. Public comment on the mine permit at Sargent Ranch ends September 26th. I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for National Native News.
A campaign is underway to rename Lane County in Oregon to recognize the region's original indigenous inhabitants. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
Critics say Joseph Lane's pro-slavery sentiments and actions against Native Americans, while Oregon's territorial governor, doesn't jibe with today's values. Richard Pettigrew of the Archaeological Legacy Institute in Eugene says he's pushing to change Lane County to Kalapuya County to reflect a more truthful narrative.
America didn't begin with Christopher Columbus. People have been here for at least 15,000 years. The Kalapuya are our link to that longer, deeper past. And the Kalapuya people are not extinct. They are here. Their descendants are here. They're part of our community. So by changing the name, we are connecting ourselves to a deeper history.
Pettigrew hopes people petition county commissioners to back his efforts. Another option commissioners have looked at is keeping Lane County, but in honor of Harry Lane, Joseph Lane's more progressive son. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
Cheyenne and Arapaho Television recently celebrated its 10-year anniversary. In 2010, the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes received a federal grant for an educational TV station. Darren Brown is senior content producer.
We've been here for 10 years, and that is significant because there are 39 federally recognized tribes here in the state of Oklahoma, but to my knowledge, we are the first and the only tribes here that actually has an actual broadcast signal. Now, it is we're licensed as a low power TV signal, which means we get a very, very small coverage area, but we're small but mighty.
The TV's native-based programming includes Indian Road, Making Regalia, and the children's show Fry Bread Flats. New seasons of those shows are in the works, and the new Zoom-based interview show, Red Talk. Cheyenne and Arapaho Television is affiliated with First Nations Experience, or FNX, a PBS station in California. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A new study calls for the end of victim blaming in financial fraud. It suggests that blame should instead be shifted to the perpetrator and that more resources should be devoted to prosecuting fraud. Eric Gladys has the story.
A new report suggests that changing how we talk about victims of financial fraud could lead to a shift in how Wyoming and the nation responds to this growing sector of criminal activity. Amy Nofziger with AARP's Fraud Watch Network, which teamed up with FINRA Investor Education Foundation on the study, says most people who experience fraud are already beating themselves up. She says using language that assigns blame to the victim is counterproductive.
Instead of using words like duped or fell for it, we need to put the blame on the criminal. That money was stolen from that person. They were a victim of this crime.
The Federal Trade Commission estimates that the cost of financial fraud reached nearly $6 billion in 2021. Nofziger says the real cost is likely much higher because many victims are too ashamed to come forward. Anyone who believes they've been a victim of fraud should contact the AARP Fraud Watch Network helpline at 877-908-3360. Nofziger says media outlets, law enforcement, banks, and others should avoid language that subtly blames the victims because it downplays the severity of the crime and makes it harder to invest in solutions. She says assigning blame to the perpetrators of fraud will help agencies better understand the actual scope of the problem.
We don't have the actual count of victims coming forward and the actual count of money being lost. By changing the language, it does make for victims to come forward in a more comfortable and well-received environment.
While 85% of Americans believe fraud can happen to anyone, 53% of those surveyed identify victims as culpable and blameworthy. Nofziger says changing the financial fraud narrative can help more law enforcement understand that it is a crime that should be investigated instead of a civil matter where someone willingly hands over their money.
we should be able to coordinate these efforts, working with the victims on these cases, working with law enforcement, working with the banks, working with the transfer companies, working with the telecom companies to get victims whole.
This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Wyoming News Service.
More frequent downpours mean more frequent flooding, but there are things homeowners can do to reduce their risk. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As the climate changes, many places are facing more intense rainfall. These downpours can overwhelm city stormwater systems and flood roads and homes. Eben Bean of the University of Florida says to prevent floods, it's important to reduce the amount of water rushing off roofs and roads and into storm drains. He says homeowners can help by directing the downspouts from their gutters onto a lawn or garden.
What happens oftentimes is people will put those downspouts and direct those onto their driveway, and it creates this continuous conveyance of stormwater from the rooftop all the way to a stormwater pond or even to a water body downstream, where there's not an opportunity for that water to even soak into the ground or be filtered in any way.
Directing water onto the landscape instead allows it to spread out and soak into the ground. And Bean says the same principle applies when building patios, sidewalks, and driveways.
Try to look at using some pervious options, porous concrete or permeable pavers that allow water to drain through rather than just run off the surface and into the storm system.
So with a few simple changes, homeowners can do their part to help prevent flooding as the climate warms. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
The United Nations chief warned yesterday that humanity is potentially close to nuclear annihilation. Secretary General Antonio Guterres sent his message at the opening of a high-level meeting intended to review the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT, a landmark 50-year-old agreement aimed at stemming the spread of nuclear weapons and eventually achieving a nuclear-free world. Guterres cited the war in Ukraine, nuclear threats in Asia and the Middle East, and many other factors in making his assessment. A danger of a nuclear catastrophe was also raised by the United States, Japan, Germany, the UN nuclear chief, and many other speakers. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken pointed to information that North Korea is preparing to conduct its seventh nuclear test, that Iran cannot or won't accept a deal to return to the 2015 nuclear agreement aimed at slowing its nuclear program, and that Russia is, quote, engaged in reckless, dangerous nuclear saber-rattling, end quote, in Ukraine. He cited Russian President Vladimir Putin saying his country is, quote, one of the most potent nuclear powers, end quote. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida said divisions in the world have become greater since the last review conference in 2015, which ended without a consensus document. Kishida said that Russia's threat to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine has contributed to, quote, worldwide concerns that yet another catastrophe by nuclear weapons is a real possibility, end quote. Other leaders accused Russia of violating assurances it gave Ukraine in 1994, when Ukraine gave up all of its nuclear weapons in exchange for economic aid and enhanced security. Russian President Vladimir Putin said his country, quote, consistently follows the letter and spirit of the NPT. Secretary General Guterres warned that geopolitical weapons are reaching new highs and that some countries are spending hundreds of billions of dollars on so-called doomsday weapons. He called on conference participants to take several actions, including urgently reaffirming what he called the 77-year-old norm against the use of nuclear weapons, working towards eliminating nuclear weapons, addressing simmering tensions in the Middle East and Asia, and promoting the peaceful use of nuclear technology. Guterres called the conference, quote, an opportunity to hammer out the measures that will help avoid certain disaster and to put humanity on a new path towards a world free of nuclear weapons, end quote. American and Australian leaders have been concerned about secret agreements between the Solomon Islands and China, but some say these worries are overblown. Leaders of Pacific Island nations want to have options, and they don't have to solely rely on Western powers for the aid they desire. Now we go to a global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. When we think of the South Pacific, pristine beaches, starry nights, and maybe the 1949 musical hit come first to mind. Now something very different is going on. Great power competition, starkly revealed in the aftermath of 3 days of rioting in November 2021 in the capital city of the Solomon Islands, located about 1,000 miles from Australia's east coast. Two issues were apparently involved: a protest of the Solomon's government's decision to switch diplomatic recognition from Taiwan to China, and anger over government corruption and neglect by people from the most densely populated and poorest of the several hundred islands that make up the Solomons. The demonstrations, which destroyed a good deal of property, were put down, but in their wake, a secret document was revealed this spring that showed the Solomons government had agreed to China's takeover of police training that once was provided by Australia. Chinese security forces might take part in putting down future demonstrations. But what drew the most attention outside the Solomons was the agreement to permit Chinese vessels access to port facilities. Revelation of the secret treaty rang alarm bells in Australia, New Zealand, and the U.S., where officials and private strategists worried that the Solomon Islands was going to become a Chinese military base in the heart of the South Pacific, a region long dominated by the U.S. and its allies. The Solomon's prime minister said speculation about a Chinese base was an insult. But regardless, such worst-case thinking in Washington is overblown. First, the central issues in the Pacific Island states are climate change, poverty, healthcare, and education. China has been forthcoming with development aid to Kiribati and Tonga, among others, and has proposed a large aid package to all the Pacific Island states that includes everything from cyber and police training to trade and investment. Whether Chinese aid can meet the needs of the PI countries remains to be seen. Some have already rejected Chinese aid out of concern about Beijing's real intentions and fear to be in the